In my younger and more vulnerable years, my father gave me some advice that I've been thinking about ever since. Whenever you feel like criticizing anyone, he told me, just remember that all the people in this world haven't had the advantages that you've had. He didn't say any more, but we've always been unusually communicative in a reserved way, and I understood that he meant much more than that. In consequence, I tend to reserve all judgments, a habit that has opened up many curious characters to me, and also made me the victim of quite a few bores. The unusual mind is quick to recognize and attach itself to this quality in a normal person. And so in college, I was unjustly accused of being a politician because I knew the secrets of wild, unknown men. Most of the confidences were unwelcome. Frequently, I have pretended to be asleep, busy, or absurdly amused when I realized that an intimate revelation was on the horizon. For the intimate revelations of young men, or at least the way they express them, are usually banal. And, after boasting of my tolerance, I have to admit that it has a limit. When I came back from the East last autumn, I felt that I wanted the world to be unchanging and at a sort of moral attention forever. I wanted no more excursions into the human heart. Only Gatsby, the man who gives his name to this book, was exempt from my reaction. Gatsby, who represented everything I naturally despise. If personality is an unbroken series of successful gestures, then there was something gorgeous about him, some exceptional sensitivity to the promises of life, as if he were related to one of those complex machines that register earthquakes 10,000 miles away. He possessed an extraordinary gift for hope, a romantic readiness, such as I have never found in any other person, and which I am not likely to ever find again. My family have been prominent, well-to-do people in this middle western city for 3 generations. The Carraways are like a clan, and we have a tradition that we're descended from the Dukes of Buccleuch. But the actual founder of my line was my grandfather's brother, who came here in 1851, sent a substitute to the Civil War, and started the wholesale hardware business that my father runs today. I never saw this great uncle, but I'm supposed to look like him. I graduated from New Haven in 1915, just a quarter of a century after my father, and a little later, I participated in the Great War. I enjoyed the counterattack so much that I came back restless. The cozy Middle West now seemed like the edge of the universe. So I decided to go east and learn the bond business. Everybody I knew was in the bond business. So I thought it could support one more single man. All my aunts and uncles talked it over, as if they were choosing a prep school for me, and finally said, "Why, yes," with very serious, hesitant faces. Father agreed to finance me for a year, and after various delays, I came east, permanently, I thought, in the spring of 1922. The practical thing was to find rooms in the city. But it was a warm season, and I had just left a country of wide lawns and friendly trees. So, when a young man at the office suggested that we take a house together in a nearby town, it sounded like a great idea. He found the house, a weather-beaten cardboard bungalow at $80 a month, but at the last minute the firm ordered him to Washington, and I went out to the country alone. I had a dog, at least I had him for a few days until he ran away, and an old Dodge and a Finnish woman, who made my bed and cooked breakfast and muttered Finnish wisdom to herself over the electric stove. It was lonely for a day or so until one morning some man, who arrived after I did, stopped me on the road. "How do you get to West Egg Village?" he asked helplessly. I told him. And as I walked on, I was no longer lonely. I was a guide, an original settler. And so with the sunshine and leaves growing fast on the trees, I had that familiar feeling that life was beginning over again with the summer. There was so much to read and so much fine health to get out of the young air. I bought 12 volumes on banking and credit and investment securities, and they stood on my shelf in red and gold, like new money from the mint. And I planned to read many other books as well. I was rather literary in college. One year I wrote a series of very solemn and obvious editorials for the Yale News. And now I was going to bring back all such things into my life and become again the well-rounded man. it was a matter of chance that I rented a house in one of the strangest communities in North America. It was on that slender island to the east of New York, and where there are, among other natural curiosities, two unusual formations of land. 20 miles from the city, a pair of enormous eggs, identical in shape and separated only by a small bay, jut out into Long Island Sound estuary. I lived at West Egg, the less fashionable of the two. My house was at the very tip of the egg, only 50 yards from the sound, and squeezed between two huge places that rented for $12,000 or $15,000 a season. The one on my right was huge by any standard. It was an imitation of some Hotel de Ville in Normandy, with a tower on one side, a marble swimming pool, and more than 40 acres of lawn and garden. It was Gatsby's mansion. Or rather, as I didn't know Mr. Gatsby, it was a mansion inhabited by a gentleman of that name. My own house was an eyesore, but it was a small eyesore, and I had a view of the water, a partial view of my neighbor's lawn, and the comforting proximity of millionaires, all for $80 a month. Across the bay, the white palaces of fashionable East Egg glittered along the water, and the history of the summer really begins on the evening I drove over there to have dinner with the Tom Buchanans. Daisy was my second cousin once removed, and I'd known Tom in college. And just after the war, I spent 2 days with them in Chicago. Her husband, among various physical achievements, had been one of the most powerful ends that ever played football at New Haven, a national figure in a way. His family were enormously wealthy. Even in college, his freedom with money was criticized. But now he'd left Chicago and come east in a fashion that rather took your breath away. For instance, he'd brought down a string of polo ponies from Lake Forest. It was hard to realize that a man in my own generation was wealthy enough to do that. Why they came east, I don't know. They had spent a year in France for no particular reason, and then moved here and there restlessly wherever people played polo and were rich together. "This was a permanent move," said Daisy over the telephone, but I didn't believe it. I had no sight into Daisy's heart, but I felt that Tom would drift on forever, looking for the dramatic turbulence of some football game he could not bring back. And so it happened that on a warm, windy evening, I drove over to East Egg to see two old friends whom I hardly knew at all. Their house was even more luxurious than I expected, a cheerful red and white Georgian colonial mansion overlooking the bay. The lawn started at the beach and ran towards the front door for a quarter of a mile, jumping over sundials and brick walks and burning gardens. The front was broken by a line of French windows, glowing now with reflected gold and wide open to the warm, windy afternoon, and Tom Buchanan in riding clothes was standing with his legs apart on the front porch. He had changed since his New Haven years. Now he was a sturdy, straw-haired man of 30, with a rather hard mouth and a bossy manner. Two shining, arrogant eyes were dominant over his face and gave him the appearance of always leaning aggressively forward. His riding clothes could not hide the enormous power of that body. He seemed to fill those shiny boots to the top lacing, and you could see a great pack of muscle shifting when his shoulder moved under his thin coat. It was a body capable of enormous power, a cruel body. His speaking voice, a husky tenor, added to the impression of unruliness he made. There was a touch of paternal contempt in it, even toward people he liked, and there were men at New Haven who had hated his guts. "Now, don't think my opinion on these matters is final," he seemed to say, "just because I'm stronger and more of a man than you are." We were in the same senior society, and while we were never close, I always had the impression that he approved of me and wanted me to like him. We talked for a few minutes on the sunny porch. "I've got a nice place here," he said, his eyes flashing around restlessly. Turning me around by one arm, he moved a broad, flat hand along the front view, including a sunken Italian garden, a half acre of deep, aromatic roses, and a motorboat that rocked offshore. It belonged to Demain, the oil man. He turned me around again, politely and suddenly. "We'll go inside." We walked through a high hallway into a bright, rosy-colored space, with French windows at each end. The windows were opened and gleaming white against the fresh grass outside that seemed to grow a little way into the house. A breeze blew through the room, blew curtains in at one end and out the other like pale flags, making a shadow on the wine-colored rug as wind does on the sea. The only completely stationary object in the room was an enormous couch on which two young women were sitting as though on an anchored balloon. They were both in white, and their dresses were fluttering as if they had just been blown back in after a short flight around the house. I must have stood for a few moments listening to the whip and snap of the curtains and the groan of a picture on the wall. Then there was a boom as Tom Buchanan shut the rear windows and the wind died out, and the curtains and the rugs and the two young women ballooned slowly to the floor. The younger of the two was a stranger to me. She was lying at her end of the divan, completely motionless, and with her chin raised a little, as if she were balancing something on it. If she saw me out of the corner of her eyes, she did not show it. Indeed, I almost murmured an apology for disturbing her by coming in. The other girl, Daisy, made an attempt to rise. She leaned slightly forward. Then she laughed, an absurd, charming little laugh. And I laughed too and came forward into the room. I'm paralyzed with happiness. She laughed again, as if she said something very witty, and held my hand for a moment, looking up into my face, promising that there was no one in the world she wanted to see so much. That was a way she had. She murmured that the surname of the balancing girl was Baker. They said that Daisy's murmur was only to make people lean toward her, a criticism that made it no less charming. Anyway, Miss Baker's lips fluttered. She nodded at me just barely, and then quickly tipped her head back again. Again, a sort of apology came to my lips. I looked back at my cousin, who began to ask me questions in her low, thrilling voice. It was the kind of voice that the ear follows up and down, as if each speech is made of notes that will never be played again. Her face was sad and lovely with bright things in it, bright eyes and a bright, passionate mouth. But there was an excitement in her voice that men who had cared for her found difficult to forget. A singing urgency, a whispered, "Listen," a promise that she had just done fun, exciting things, and that there were fun, exciting things happening in the next hour. I told her how I had stopped off in Chicago for a day on my way east, and how a dozen people had sent their love through me. "Do they miss me?" she cried ecstatically. "The whole town is desolate. All the cars have the left rear wheel, painted black as a mourning wreath, and there's a constant wail all night along the North Shore. How gorgeous. Let's go back, Tom, tomorrow." Then she added irrelevantly, "You ought to see the baby." "I'd like to. She's asleep. She's 3 years old." "Haven't you ever seen her?" "Never." "Well, you ought to see her. She's..." Tom Buchanan, who had been moving restlessly around the room, stopped and rested his hand on my shoulder. "What are you doing, Nick?" "I'm a bond man." "Who with?" I told him. "Never heard of them," he remarked decisively. This annoyed me. "You will," I answered shortly. "You will if you stay in the East." "Oh, I'll stay in the East. Don't you worry," he said, glancing at Daisy, and then back at me, as if he were alert for something more. "I'd be a goddamn fool to live anywhere else." At this point, Miss Baker said, "Absolutely." So suddenly that I started, it was the first word she had uttered since I came into the room. Evidently, it surprised her as much as it did me, for she yawned and stood up. "I'm stiff," she complained. "I've been lying on that sofa for as long as I can remember." "Don't look at me," Daisy replied. "I've been trying to get you to New York all afternoon." "No, thanks," said Miss Baker to the four cocktails just in from the pantry. "I'm absolutely in training." Her host looked at her in disbelief. "You are." He finished his drink as if it were a drop in the bottom of a glass. "How you ever get anything done is beyond me." I looked at Miss Baker, wondering what it was she got done. I enjoyed looking at her. She was a slender, small-breasted girl, with an erect posture of a young cadet. Her gray, sun-strained eyes looked back at me with polite curiosity out of a pale, charming, dissatisfied face. It occurred to me now that I had seen her, or picture of her, somewhere before. "You live in West Egg," she remarked contemptuously. "I know somebody there." "I don't know a single..." "You must know Gatsby." "Gatsby?" asked Daisy. "What Gatsby?" Before I could reply that he was my neighbor, dinner was announced. Tom Buchanan put his tense arm under mine and forced me from the room as though he were moving a checker to another square. The two slender young women went lazily before us, out onto a rosy-colored porch, open toward the sunset, where four candles flickered on the table. "Why candles?" objected Daisy, frowning. She snapped them out with her fingers. "In 2 weeks, it'll be the longest day in the year." She looked at us all radiantly. "Do you always watch for the longest day of the year and then miss it?" "I always watch for the longest day in the year and then miss it." "We ought to plan something," yawned Miss Baker, sitting down at the table, as if she were getting into bed. "All right," said Daisy. "What will we plan?" She turned to me helplessly. "What do people plan?" Before I could answer, her eyes focused on her little finger. "Look," she complained. "I heard it." We all looked. The knuckle was black and blue. "You did it, Tom," she said accusingly. "I know you didn't mean to, but you did do it. That's what I get for marrying a brute of a man, a great big hulking physical specimen of a—" "I hate that word hulking," objected Tom crossly. "Even in kidding." "Hulking," insisted Daisy. Sometimes she and Miss Baker talked at once, and their chatter was as cool as their white dresses and their impersonal bored eyes. They were here, and they accepted Tom and me, making only a polite, pleasant effort to entertain or to be entertained. They knew that soon dinner would be over, and a little later the evening too would be over and casually put away. It was very different from the West, where an evening was hurried from phase to phase toward its close, in a continually disappointed expectation or in nervous dread of the moment itself. "You make me feel uncivilized, Daisy," I confessed on my second glass of red wine. "Can't you talk about crops or something?" I meant nothing in particular by this remark, but it was taken up in an unexpected way. "Civilization's going to pieces," said Tom violently. "I've become a terrible pessimist about things. Have you read The Rise of the Colored Empires by this man Goddard?" "Why, no," and I answered, rather surprised by his tone. "Well, it's a fine book, and everybody ought to read it. The idea is if we don't look out, the white race will be completely submerged. It's all scientific stuff. It's been proved." "Tom's getting very intellectual," said Daisy, with an expression of sadness. "He reads deep books with long words in them. What was that word we—" "Well, these books are all scientific," insisted Tom, glancing at her impatiently. "This fellow has worked out the whole thing. It's up to us who are the dominant race to watch out, or these other races will have control of things." "We've got to beat them down," whispered Daisy, winking toward the burning sun. "You ought to live in California," began Miss Baker, but Tom interrupted her by shifting heavily in his chair. "This idea is that we're Nordics. I am, and you are, and you are, and—" After a moment of hesitation, he included Daisy with a slight nod, and she winked at me again. "And we've produced all the things that make civilization, oh, science and art and all that. Do you see?" There was something pathetic in his concentration. When, almost immediately, the telephone rang inside and the butler left the porch, Daisy used the momentary interruption and leaned toward me. "I'll tell you a family secret," she whispered enthusiastically. "It's about the butler's nose. Do you want to hear about the butler's nose? That's why I came over tonight. Well, he wasn't always a butler. He used to be the silver polisher for some people in New York that had a silver service for 200 people. He had to polish it from morning till night, until finally it began to affect his nose. Things went from bad to worse," suggested Miss Baker. "Yes, things went from bad to worse, until finally he had to give up his position." For a moment, the last sunshine fell with romantic affection upon her glowing face. Her voice held me breathless as I listened. Then the glow faded and light left her with regret, like children leaving a pleasant street at dusk. The butler came back and murmured something close to Tom's ear. Tom frowned, pushed back his chair, and without a word, went inside. As if his absence quickened something within her, Daisy leaned forward again, her voice glowing and singing. "I love to see you at my table, Nick. You remind me of a rose, an absolute rose. Doesn't he?" She turned to Miss Baker for confirmation. "An absolute rose?" This was untrue. I am not even faintly like a rose. She was only making it up. But such warmth flowed from her, as if her heart was trying to come out to you, hidden in one of those breathless, thrilling words. Then suddenly, she threw her napkin on the table and excused herself and went into the house. Miss Baker and I exchanged a short glance. I was about to speak when she sat up alertly and said, "Shh," in a warning voice. A quiet murmur came from the room beyond, and Miss Baker leaned forward unashamed, trying to hear. "This Mr. Gatsby you spoke of is my neighbor," I began. "Don't talk. I want to hear what happens." "Is something happening?" I asked innocently. "You mean to say you don't know?" said Miss Baker, honestly surprised. "I thought everybody knew." "I don't." "Why?" she said hesitantly. "Tom's got some woman in New York." "Got some woman?" I repeated blankly. Miss Baker nodded. "She should have the decency not to telephone him at dinner time, don't you think?" Almost before I had understood what she meant, there was the flutter of a dress and the crunch of leather boots, and Tom and Daisy were back at the table. "It couldn't wait," cried Daisy, with tense cheer. She sat down, glanced at Miss Baker and then at me, and continued, "I looked outdoors for a minute, and it's very romantic outdoors. There's a bird on the lawn that I think must be a nightingale. He's singing away." Her voice sang, "It's romantic, isn't it, Tom?" "Very romantic," he said, and then miserably to me, "If it's light enough after dinner, I want to take you down to the stables." The telephone rang inside suddenly. Daisy shook her head decisively at Tom, and the subject of the stables, in fact all subjects, vanished into air. What I remember of the last 5 minutes at table was that the candles were lit again, pointlessly, and I tried to avoid all eyes. I couldn't guess what Daisy and Tom were thinking, but I doubt if even Miss Baker was able to put this fifth guest's shrill metallic urgency out of mind. To some temperament, the situation might have seemed intriguing. My own instinct was to telephone immediately for the police. The horses, needless to say, were not mentioned again. Tom and Miss Baker, with several feet of twilight between them, strolled back into the library. Trying to look pleasantly interested and a little deaf, I followed Daisy around a chain of connecting verandas to the porch in front. In its deep gloom, we sat down side by side on a wicker settee. Daisy took her face in her hands as if feeling its lovely shape, and her eyes moved into the velvet dusk. I saw that turbulent emotions possessed her, so I asked what I thought would be some calming questions about her little girl. "We don't know each other very well, Nick," she said suddenly. "Even if we are cousins, you didn't come to my wedding." "I wasn't back from the war."
"That's true."
She hesitated.
"Well, I've had a very bad time, Nick, and I'm pretty cynical about everything."
Evidently, she had reason to be. I waited, but she didn't say any more. And after a moment, I returned rather weakly to the subject of her daughter.
"I suppose she talks and eats and everything."
"Oh, yes." She looked at me absently. "Listen, Nick. Let me tell you what I said when she was born. Would you like to hear?"
"Very much."
"It'll show you how I've gotten to feel about things. Well, she was less than an hour old and Tom was God knows where. I woke up out of the ether with a completely abandoned feeling and asked the nurse right away if it was a boy or a girl. She told me it was a girl, and so I turned my head away and cried. "All right," I said, "I'm glad it's a girl. And I hope she'll be a fool. That's the best thing a girl can be in this world. A beautiful little fool." "You see, I think everything's terrible anyhow," she went on. "Everybody thinks so. The most advanced people. And I know. I've been everywhere and seen everything and done everything." Her eyes flashed around her in a daring way, rather like Tom's, and she laughed with thrilling sarcasm. "Sophisticated. God, I'm sophisticated." The moment her voice broke off, I felt the basic insincerity of what she had said. It made me uneasy, as though the whole evening had been a trick of some sort. I waited, and sure enough, in a moment, she looked at me with an absolute smirk on her lovely face, as if she had confirmed her membership in a rather distinguished secret society to which she and Tom belonged. Inside, the crimson room bloomed with light. Tom and Miss Baker sat at either end of the long couch, and she read aloud to him from the Saturday Evening Post, the words running together in a soothing tune, the lamplight, bright on his boots and dull on the autumn leaf yellow of her hair,
glinted on the paper as she turned a page with her slender arms. When we came in, she held us silent for a moment with a lifted hand. "To be continued," she said, tossing the magazine on the table. "In our very next issue." And she stood up. 10 o'clock, she remarked, apparently finding the time on the ceiling. "Time for this good girl to go to bed." "Jordan's going to play in the tournament tomorrow," explained Daisy, "over at Westchester." "Oh, you're Jordan Baker." I knew now why her face was familiar. Its pleasing expression had looked out at me from many pictures of the sporting life at Asheville and Hot Springs and Palm Beach. I had heard some story of her, too, a critical, unpleasant story, but what it was, I had forgotten long ago. "Good night," she said softly. "Wake me at 8, won't you? If you'll get up." "I will." "Good night, Mr. Caraway. See you soon." "Of course you will," I confirmed Daisy. "In fact, I think I'll arrange a marriage. Come over often, Nick, and I'll sort of, fling you together. You know, lock you up accidentally in linen closets and push you out to sea in a boat and all that sort of thing." "Good night," called Miss Baker from the stairs. "I haven't heard a word." "She's a nice girl," said Tom after a moment. "They oughtn't to let her run around the country this way." "Who oughtn't to?" inquired Daisy coldly. "Her family?" "Her family is one aunt about 1,000 years old. Besides, Nick's going to look after her, aren't you, Nick? She's going to spend lots of weekends out here this summer. I think the home influence will be very good for her." Daisy and Tom looked at each other for a moment in silence. "Is she from New York?" I asked quickly. "From Louisville. Our white girlhood was passed together there. Our beautiful white..." "Did you give Nick a little heart-to-heart talk on the veranda?" demanded Tom suddenly. "Did I?" She looked at me. "I can't seem to remember, but I think we talked about the Nordic race." "Yes, I'm sure we did." "Don't believe everything you hear, Nick," he advised me. I said lightly that I had heard nothing at all, and a few minutes later I got up to go home. They came to the door with me and stood side by side in a cheerful square of light. As I started my motor, Daisy called, "Wait, I forgot to ask you something, and it's important. We heard you were engaged to a girl out west." "That's right," confirmed Tom kindly. "We heard that you were engaged." "It's a libel. I'm too poor." "But we heard it," insisted Daisy, surprising me by opening up again in a flower-like way. "We heard it from 3 people, so it must be true." Of course I knew what they were referring to, but I wasn't even vaguely engaged. The fact was that the gossip was one of the reasons I had come east. You can't stop seeing an old friend on account of rumors. And on the other hand, I had no intention of being rumored into marriage. Their interest rather touched me and made them less rich. Nevertheless, I was confused and a little disgusted as I drove away. It seemed to me that the thing for Daisy to do was to rush out of the house, child in arms. But apparently there were no such intentions in her head. As for Tom, the fact that he had some woman in New York was really less surprising than that he had been depressed by a book. Already it was deep summer on roadhouse roofs and in front of roadside garages where new red petrol pumps sat out in pools of light. When I reached my home at West Egg, I parked the car under its shed and sat for a while on an old grass roller in the yard. The wind had blown off, leaving a loud, bright night, with wings beating in the trees and a persistent organ sound of the frogs. The silhouette of a cat moved across the moonlight, and turning my head to watch it, I saw that I was not alone. 50 feet away, a figure had appeared from the shadow of my neighbor's mansion and was standing with his hands in his pockets, looking at the silver pepper of the stars. Something in his leisurely movements and the secure position of his feet upon the lawn suggested that it was Mr. Gatsby himself who came out to check what share of our local heavens was his. I decided to call to him. Miss Baker had mentioned him at dinner, and that would do for an introduction. But I didn't call to him, for he looked like he was happy to be alone. He stretched out his arms toward the dark water in a curious way. And far as I was from him, I was sure he was trembling. Involuntarily, I glanced toward the water and saw nothing except a single green light, tiny and far away, that might have been the end of a dock. When I looked once more for Gatsby, he had disappeared, and I was alone again in the unquiet darkness.